Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
Hello, welcome to the Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. A few months ago, Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, resigned after reports of a chilling history of sexual violence towards women. That opened a race to replace him, and Zephyr Teachout, a Fordham law professor who had previously run for governor of New York, threw her hat in the ring. Teachout's candidacy has gained a lot of momentum recently. The New York Times endorsed her, saying that she was unusually well-prepared to curb abuses of power and restore integrity and pride to the office. Now, New York Attorney General doesn't sound like the kind of race we usually cover here, but it's different right now. And the reason is that Donald Trump's businesses are in New York. His family works in New York. His associates worked in New York. When Bob Mueller referred Michael Cohen for prosecution, it was to New York prosecutors. And for all the talk of Trump's pardon power, he can pardon against federal prosecution, not state prosecution. So the Attorney General of New York is one of the only people actually able to make sure that Donald Trump and the things people in his orbit have done are actually subject to the rule of law. And Teachout is a fascinating entrant into this race because that's what she thinks about. When I had her on this podcast back in June of 2017, it was because she's one of the country's leading experts on political corruption, what it means, what the founding fathers wanted done about it, how the law is constructed around it right now. That conversation is all the more relevant now because the election for Attorney General is on September 13th. So we're reposting it here. Please enjoy my discussion with Zephyr Teachout. Zephyr Teachout, welcome to the podcast.
Wonderful to be on.
We met briefly, I think, but we met on the Dean campaign so many moons ago.
I was just thinking about that. I remember sitting in one of those like windowless rooms with you and Joe Trippi, and he was so excited because there was this young blogger, Ezra Klein. And if Ezra Klein was going to be supporting us, everything was going to be better.
Joe Trippi was excited by anything at all times. He's an excitable guy.
Yeah.
But I was there only for 2 months, but you were, because I was just an intern during a summer once, but you were a big presence. You were like the online organizer. You were creating the future of politics there. What did you do on the Dean campaign?
Well, I actually didn't come on as an internet person. I came on to organize the rural states. And then, of course, it turns out the way to organize rural states is, at the time, use something called Meetup, which you're all now familiar with.
Meetup.
Yes. And
I am familiar with and also have forgotten about.
But basically, I was the director of online organizing. And what that meant is a few different things. One, which is really fun and exciting at the time, is we hired the first software developers for a presidential campaign to build our own MySpace. You know, this is before Facebook, remember? So we were trying to build our own social network for Howard Dean supporters. And that went on actually to be used by Obama's campaign in 2008 with a different underlying code, but the same basic structure was bought by the firm that ran that. And but then I also did a lot of blogging, which was a lot of fun. And most of the blogging I was doing at the time was about engaging and organizing volunteers. And it was a moment in the early aughts where there was a sense like, oh, we're finally let free from the curse of the television and the curse of the passive the passive supporter of candidates. Now you can actually do something. And obviously a lot's happened since then. But it was a really exciting time to say, oh, I don't just have to give money or vote. I can organize. I can do more than that.
I look back on that campaign in that moment, and I always think it's something that today we underestimate how much we are in its lineage, just how much of what we think of as contemporary politics began like right then and right there. Because the Dean campaign, it was really the first digital campaign. And it was the first that began to put into play, I think, a lot of strategies that would ultimately come to define Obama, come to define Trump, come to define Sanders. But a lot of it began there. How did you become, from organizing rural states, how did you become the internet maven? Did you have a background in digital organizing?
No, I just used to use the internet to dream of places I could go on Expedia. You know, how much would it cost to go to
Burlington,
Hawaii?
Vermont.
Exactly. But I actually feel that way too, that was a really important early moment. And I mean, in very specific ways, the Obama software came out of that campaign. And then the Obama software was mimicked by a lot of other campaigns. But also, we were one of the first campaigns to say, we're going to let go some of the control and allow for mashups, which are now much more normal, but allow, you know, supporters to make their own posters. This was seen as very radical at the time. Like, all the posters were supposed to come from the campaign, top down. And then, you know, there's some really positive things about that, and also some really interesting side effects from that. In 2003, I believed we'd sort of cracked the nut, that we weren't going to be based on big donor politics anymore. Big donor politics were done. There was this thing that only a few of you Howard Dean junkies will remember, but we now see echoes of it all the time, where there was, we had a bat.
Image. Oh, I remember the bat.
Right. But we basically had a public show of all the money we were raising as we were raising it. So every $25, you'd see it. See the bat get filled up with higher and higher levels.
You're going to, do I remember this right? $15 million? Wasn't that the
Yes, the exactly. Effort? Right. It isn't quaint, but now it seems quaint.
But it was I was there that summer. That was the summer I was there when the bat was happening. And that number was – it was laughable. Like, the idea that that was even possible, it was shocking at that moment in politics that you could do that from small donors. Like, it just hadn't been done.
It hadn't been done. Howard Dean wasn't being taken that seriously. And I think one of the things you're talking about probably with the echoes is that it showed that the party doesn't get to choose, because Howard Dean was very clearly not the choice of the Democratic Party. Interesting that he became, you know, the chair of the DNC. But there was a lot of disdain for his candidacy, and he didn't have any of the usual party mechanisms. And so he showed that you could actually build support outside of those party mechanisms. And of course, you've seen a lot of that with both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
So this is something that I wanted to talk about. It's one reason I wanted to begin the conversation in Dean, because there are two mechanisms by which I think he changed things. There are two mechanisms, at least it's interesting to trace. There's one, which is the how did he do politics, right? The internet organizing meetup, which then the social platforms developed, which became much more powerful forms of that. The online fundraising, which Sanders and Obama both, you know, blew what Dean was able to do out of the water. All that has advanced, and all that I think has taken a different shape than it had at that moment. It's become much more professionalized, if nothing else.
Absolutely.
But the other is the ideological moment that was in. I mean, Dean was the left-wing insurgent. He was from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And yet, I think if you go back to that moment, part of the whole argument for Dean, though he was anti-war, you know, he had been a kind of DLC guy, even though now he was in a fight with them. He was a technocrat. He was actually often portrayed as sort of the moderate compared to like that nutty Vermont politician, Bernie Sanders, who is, you know, also in the same state as him. And one thing that seems to me to be interesting about the after effects of that campaign is that those things have changed. How he did politics has given rise to a kind of politician that is very un-Dean-like, that is actually much less the party establishment than Dean ever was. I'm curious how you see the Dean to Sanders lineage.
I think that's really interesting because the, you know, I grew up in Vermont, and so I never thought of Howard Dean as left-wing.
Right, because he wasn't.
Because he wasn't, you know. And when I went to volunteer on his campaign, I was really excited about his view on the war and his focus on healthcare, but I didn't sort of think of him as a left-wing firebrand. And it was a little strange even to see him being portrayed as that, as this radical outsider, because that's just not who he is. As you say, not who he is ideologically and not who he had been as a governor. I do think there are some, there's something that's similar and that it probably does come from the Vermont roots in some way, is some real comfort. Both Governor Dean and Bernie Sanders are incredibly comfortable with, or have shown they're uncomfortable with, letting go of power in their process. So letting grassroots people do a lot of things without a kind of check. And I sometimes wonder if that comes out of the congregational rural Vermont tradition of incredible decentralized power. And there's also, again, they're very different ideologically, but a similarity in a kind of straightforward lack of pomp that they both have. You know, Howard Dean, I forget how many years exactly, but was still wearing the same suit he'd been wearing for 20 years. And Bernie Sanders is kind of famously rumpled. And so they're similar in those ways. Deeply different, as you say, ideologically. And I mean, I got to say that Bernie Sanders having national support in the way that he did totally shocked me. Certainly having followed his career in Vermont, I didn't expect anything.
But one of the things that I think is really interesting about the Dean to Obama to Sanders line, if you want to draw a line there, is that, as you say, I think they all have very different styles of politics. They all have different ideologies to some degree or another. But the one thing they share, even though they articulate it in different ways, is an incorruptibility might be going too far. But there were ways Dean, in confronting the party establishment and raising all these money from small donors, Barack Obama with his hope and change, also coming from outside initially the party establishment, sort of a new face in American politics, and then Sanders, who has been sort of a Democratic gadfly for a long time. All of them were sort of small donor financed, at least to some large degree. Obama obviously had a fair amount of big donor money too. And what seems sort of interesting to me is that the people, the politicians who are able to exist in that reformist space, they can have a lot of different ideologies and actually different levels of confrontation with the system. But they all need to have some way of signaling to the voters that I am not corrupted by the system in the way these other people are. And that seems to me to be the sort of tie between them all.
That's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about Governor Dean as being connected to that line, but I certainly see what you're saying. I would just sort of add to that, that I think that the markers of not being corrupted, or the public demand for those markers, has changed, so that you need a lot more evidence that you're really not one of them. And it'd be interesting if, you know, Governor Dean ran today, whether he would be sort of considered to have those reformist characteristics. Because one of the things that I certainly see when I talk, not just to young people, but to people who are really independents, people who are really disaffected with politics, is they want to see their politicians name names. They're not, if you say you're an economic populist, people's eyes roll. Like, yeah, sure, you're an economic populist. Everybody says they're an economic populist. You say you fight for the working people, fine. But what I heard a lot is one of the reasons that people trusted Bernie is that he was actually willing to name names of big corporations that people felt were in opposition. It was kind of a badge, as you say, sort of a signifier that he was a serious reformer. I mean, it's one of the dangerous things about this revolutionary moment we're in is that people get more and more cynical, and they demand, you know, higher and higher degrees of proof that you're not one of them. You're not a corruptible.
And Trump has this too. I mean, he fought his own party. He fights the media. All that matters. This has been a somewhat winding road, but one reason I wanted to establish this kind of a baseline for the conversation is that there's a lot I want to talk to you about, your lawsuit you're involved in against Donald Trump, some of the work you've been doing on monopolies. But I wanted to begin with corruption and the role it's playing in American life. You've written a fantastic book on this. And the thing that I think is sort of interesting about anti-corruption politics as practiced by the politicians who are clearly connecting with the public on it, and then corruption in politics as it has been defined by the people with the power to legally define it, are so different, right? I mean, we are seeing anti-corruption politics. It is, people are so skeptical of the system that simply being able to say fuck off to your own party, right? The idea that you would even be influenced by your party is corruption, right? That makes people uncomfortable. And then with the Supreme Court, where it's like, unless you have handed somebody a bag right. with a dollar sign on it, there's no corruption. So why don't we begin here? Yeah. How was corruption thought of by the framers?
Yeah.
And how is it defined in American jurisprudence today?
Great. So great question. So important. I think so important as we're now struggling with country in a crisis. At the founding, at the Constitutional Convention, corruption was really the topic of the convention. They actually talked about corruption more than they talked about internal violence, which was a big topic at the time, you know, Shays' Rebellion. They talked about it more than they talked about the threat of violence from outside, other foreign countries coming in and attacking. Having decided to form a country out of our states, really, in some ways, if not one of the major themes of the convention is how can we protect against corruption?
Why were they so concerned with that?
Well, they were smart, first of all. but they were concerned because that's what they had seen in England. They had seen it creeping into the states, the intrigues and corruption creeping into the new states. And then also there's this historical accident, which is that Gibbon's History of the Fall of Rome actually came out during the Articles of Confederation and during the pre-constitutional period. So the framers were reading Gibbon as it came out as this sort of gripping story of how this once great republic, Rome, had been rent apart and torn apart by the internal corruption in Rome. So there's literary reasons and historical reasons, and then their own struggles with England all informed that. And in what they're saying was actually fairly traditional, if you even go back to Aristotle, though, which is that it is the fate of all republics to be threatened by corruption. And this is the central struggle of a republic is to keep corruption at bay. So later, when Alexander Hamilton was talking about the Constitutional Convention, he said, "We tried to erect every practicable obstacle to corruption." You know, this was sort of the task. Or when Patrick Henry was talking about England, he said, you know, they basically had it right. He said, it's the finest fabric that history has ever reared, but it was rent apart by corruption. So they really saw it as the threat to self-government. And when they talked about corruption, they were not thinking about how many times somebody violates a bribery law. They were thinking about when those in public power use that public power for private ends. So just, I mentioned Aristotle, but I think it's always worth going back to Aristotle, it's
frequent. Always.
Always. Aristotle described six forms of government, as you may recall, the three ideal types and the three corrupted types.
Thank you for suggesting I might recall that, yes. I appreciate your confidence in me.
I have complete confidence. And the difference between the ideal types and the corrupted types, so the one is the monarchy, that's the ideal type. And the corrupted type is the tyrant, or the aristocracy is the ideal type, and the corrupted type is the oligarchy. The language with the masses governing is a little more awkward because they actually called the corrupted type the democracy. But the difference between the two is that the monarch...
Wait, what was the ideal type called in the masses governing?
It's something like, I mean, the translation isn't perfect, but you call it a polity or timocracy, brotherly love.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But the basic thing that...
I mean, obviously I recalled that. I'm just asking for the audience.
The basic difference between the two is the monarch looks out for the interest of the public and the tyrant looks after his own interests. Or in the oligarchy and aristocracy. And aristocracy is a rule by the few, but they care about the public. And so that's what... when they were talking about corruption, they were saying when those in power care about their own interests. We don't care whether you're violating a criminal statute. And in fact, it's kind of crazy. There's this modern tendency to look, to have what you might call a positivist approach, where you say it's only corrupt if it's against the law. And the thing that's crazy about that and strange about that is it means that if you're in a deeply corrupt society that hasn't outlawed bribery, then bribery isn't corrupt. It becomes circular. So you can't really look to the laws themselves. You have to look to the intentions of the leaders.
And so I want to get to Citizens United and the way it's being defined now, I just want to sort of sharpen this a little bit more.
Sure.
What would you say, if you just had to put it down as definition,
yes,
was their definition of corruption?
When those in public power use that power for private ends.
What does private mean there?
Selfish, narrow, their own.
How do you define what is my end? Right? Because one thing human beings are great at.
Yes.
Is... imagining that my that ends are right. the country's ends, or but you can structure this more decently, right? I believe it was I could be wrong, but I think it's cool that you said the business of America is business, mm-hmm. right? And I don't know the exact context of that quote, but he could have really meant it, right? That, you know, whatever is good for, or as it was said at a different point, whatever is good for GE is good for America. So how do you separate the great. Private and the
great.
Public?
So I actually, and I think this is really important because in some ways these contemporary debates that we're having about the meaning of corruption actually go down to a view of human nature. So I think I'd start with human nature. This is very broad, but you can look at the founders as taking a side in the fight between Hobbes and Montesquieu. So Hobbes had a view of human nature as fundamentally egotistical, self-seeking, and kind of openly so. Yeah, you mask some of it and you think it's good for others, but that people are always only going to seek their own interests. Montesquieu and the framers thought that people were capable of serving the public interest, capable of serving their own interest. And the question is, what kind of structures do you have that encourage people to do more public interest serving and less private interest serving? You're asking a kind of evidentiary question, like, you know, how do we know? And the reason this question is so important is because to some degree, it's incredibly hard to know when you see a corrupt act. I could see you doing something and I may guess that it's a corrupt act, but I will never know that it's a corrupt act. However, I will know that if there's 100 different people taking money in a campaign context and then making policy decisions, I'm not going to know which ones are corrupted by that money taking. Maybe even if I knocked on their soul, I wouldn't know, you know, because they may, as you suggest, hide from themselves their true intention. But if I set up a system where you have to spend your time begging for money, I can make you a strong bet that a lot of those people are taking money and then switching their position because of that money. So that you actually, because of their view of corruption, because of, in some ways, the difficulty of knowing of a particular instance of corruption, you actually had to have laws that just made corruption less likely, not laws that, after the fact, criminalized corruption. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And so this, I think, is a good bridge to the Citizens United basket of decisions, because yeah. it's a bunch of different decisions. But I'd love you to talk about that for a couple minutes, because the thing that is so remarkable to me about those decisions is I could really imagine having gotten to the end result they got to by asking what I would consider to be the wrong question, by saying, well, it just is not acceptable under the First Amendment to regulate spending money on politics for any reason. And so here we go. This is what we've got. Instead, they ask what I think of as the right question. They sort of set up this test that we should be able to regulate money in politics to protect against both corruption and the appearance of corruption. And then somehow, having asked a reasonable question, they come up with the most insanely unreasonable answer I could possibly imagine about what constitutes the appearance of corruption. So where did they get there?
Oh, wow. Well, it starts with a very important case, Buckley versus Vallejo, a 1976 case. You know, Benjamin Franklin thought the country could resist corruption for 200 years. You sort of joke that he didn't know he'd get it that precisely right. But it starts with this 1976 case, Buckley versus Vallejo, which is a very hastily written case. And in that case—
Hastily written?
Actually, a lot of election laws are election law cases are hastily written because you want to figure out what rules apply before the election. And in that case, the court comes down with a decision analyzing the post-Watergate reforms, the election law reforms, and coming up with a split approach, saying we're going to treat campaign contributions in one way and allow regulations limiting campaign contributions in one way, and we're going to treat regulations regarding campaign expenditures in another. We've been living inside this world for 41 years, and yet nobody on the court likes it. So you're right to say it's kind of a weird structure. Everything about the structure is weird. There's been a 5-4 bounce back and forth, but never enough of a majority to actually overturn the fundamental structure.
Okay, so I just want to reflect this back to you because this is really helpful for me, and I want to make sure I understand it. So what you're saying is that the question was not structured by this court.
Right.
Being able to regulate for the appearance of corruption, that's just where they have to take that as a given, because they don't have either the interest or the votes to revisit Buckley v. Valeo.
To revisit, and even within their own coalitions, they can't necessarily revisit the underlying structure. So the structure is corruption plus appearance of corruption. They then fight within, among each other, and even within their own factions about what is the meaning of corruption and what is appearance of corruption. But it's led to some really weird things, because a lot of people think, hey, we should also care about, say, political equality, right? That might be a concern. But political equality isn't corruption. So instead, you get people arguing who really care about political equality, but they'll say, oh, but that's corruption. They'll call all kinds of things corruption so they can count it in the corruption box. And then on the other side, there are people who basically just don't believe in campaign finance regulation. And so they've whittled down the meaning of corruption to mean almost nothing, to mean what they call quid pro quo corruption, and not understanding what its historical meaning is.
What is quid pro quo corruption?
Great question. I think it's the court thinking that it sounds specific because it's Latin, when it's not, in fact, that specific itself. The Sixth Circuit once said, not all quids are made of the same stuff, because the definition of quid pro quo corruption itself has been so disputed for several years in criminal law. The court in the conservative part of the court, in an effort to narrow corruption, has started to say corruption only means quid pro quo corruption. What's funny about that is quid pro quo is actually a Latin term that applies to contract law, not criminal law.
What does it mean?
Relative equality of exchange.
Quid pro quo means relative equality of exchange?
Yeah.
Oh, I would have thought it was something snappier than that. It kind of sounds like it's like this for that or something.
Right, right. That's, well, this for that is another way. You can say this for that. But I do think that there's something kind of funny happening here, where it sounds like, oh, we're just doing quid pro quo. That sounds like a manageable standard. There are clear lines there, just because it's Latin.
Yeah.
Right. But they've narrowed it, and it appears that what the current court thinks is quid pro quo corruption, which they think is the only kind of corruption, is when there has been an explicit exchange. So I say, Ezra, I will give you this campaign donation. In exchange, will you promise to vote against the TPP? You know, it's really, really explicit.
I just want to hit the boundaries of this a little bit. If I am an anti-TPP trade group,
yes,
called Burn the TPP to the Ground,
right,
and I max out to your campaign,
yes,
and to your PAC,
yes,
and to whatever else I can think of that you might enjoy, but we have not somehow publicly signed a contract, and then you come out and you vote against the TPP, that is not quid pro quo corruption.
That's correct. Yeah. And that is the state of our current
right. That's what happens
system.
All the time.
It happens all the time. Just,
that to me is a crazy thing that they did.
Yeah.
This idea that just giving campaign donations when you clearly have a rooting interest, and maybe you're giving them to everybody on all sides of an issue,
yeah,
that doesn't create the appearance of corruption. It's like they've never spoken to a human being.
Right. Now that's what you feel like. And right, if they're going to use appearance, not just corruption, then what do they mean by appearance? And there's been some really interesting social science research on this. But basically, whose appearance? Because lots of people, of course, think this entire system is corrupt, but they aren't willing to call the system corrupt. And to be fair to the Supreme Court, the McCormick case was the case, I think it was the early 80s, that decided that campaign contributions would have a different standard, a looser standard. And basically they said, if we don't allow that, we don't have any other way to fund campaigns. So we can't criminalize what is the most daily practice of campaigns right now. So one of the things that's been really interesting is that there's two areas of corruption law that the Supreme Court has been narrowing. It's been narrowing corruption law in one sense, in that it continues to strike down anti-corruption rules because they are violative of the First Amendment. At the same time, it's also been narrowing bribery law. And in each category of case, it says, go look at the other category of case to deal with it. Like in this Citizens United, it says, if you have a problem with this, use bribery law to address these issues. And the citizens are left with very little, because we have neither robust anti-bribery protections nor robust campaign finance rules.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity.
But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
So one of the things that I want to point out, because I think it's interesting and I think it's important, is there's a kind of crucial difference between the way you phrase how the founders thought about corruption and what we're looking at here. And that is that the founders, again, from the way you described it, were thinking about corruption on the part of the lawmaker. Is the lawmaker or the public official working in selfish interest? Appearance of corruption, in theory, is thinking about it on the part of the voter or just the citizen, right? Does this system look rotten to you? And one, that's just is a big shift. But two, what's so strange is that it would seem the shift to the latter would end up with much more aggressive forms of anti-corruption jurisprudence and legislation. I mean, when I talk to people about American politics, I sometimes feel bad for politicians who get a ton more guilt by association than I think they often deserve, right? Almost nothing they do is taken at face value, right? Even if it was like something they deeply believed in, because everything looks corrupt when there's so much money flowing in and out of the system. And so I know this is a dumb question, but how is the Supreme Court able, with a straight face, to look at the way Americans think about politics? Just look at the way they talk about it all the time. Look at what happens when you poll them on it and say that they are not concerned about the appearance of corruption within not just the system we had a couple of years ago, but they're willing to open it up even further.
Yeah, I mean, what you could say that the court is disingenuous. You could say that when the court says appearance of corruption, they're then piggybacking their own definition of corruption. So they don't mean do a lot of people think it's corrupt. They mean do a lot of people think there's a quid pro quo exchange.
Although they do think that.
Right. I see what you're saying.
I mean, what I just think but is weird about think, this.
But I've actually tried to figure out this court as well. In particular, again, it's a 5-4 split. And with a different Supreme Court, had Hillary Clinton been elected, depending on who she nominated, with a different Supreme Court, Citizens United could have been overturned. And then quite possibly Buckley in the other cases that led up to Citizens United. But what I've tried to understand is these five members of the court, what really, really drives them. And I think I'll just throw out some hypotheses, because looking into the hearts of Supreme Court justices is not easy. One is that they're actually kind of naive about government, and they kind of think everything's going to be okay. So I think of this as kind of a post, especially post-Berlin Wall set of beliefs, an end of history idea that, yeah, there's some corruption problems, but fundamentally, we've got domestic tranquility. We're providing for the common defense. You know, the preamble of the Constitution is met. We've got a stable state. Everything's okay. So they aren't that worried. And again, this isn't doesn't answer your question about how can they say there's no appearance of corruption. It answers the question of like, how can they not be worried about what's happening in the world and the level of disaffection on the part of citizens. Another is a belief that democracy itself, and this drives some of the neoliberal thinking, is that democracy itself may not be the best way to figure out who gets what goods, and the marketplace is a better way to allocate goods and services. And that they actually, it's not that they think there isn't an appearance of corruption, it's they think that democracy itself is always corrupt, so deeply corrupt that our little rules and regulations won't help. And then another more sort of intellectually honest way is to say what you were saying earlier, which is they just are First Amendment absolutists and think anytime the government is telling any entity not to speak, we've got a problem.
So then let's back out from the imperfect place we've ended up to where we should be. If we viewed corruption, you have a very nice line in your book where you say that I am trying to bring corruption back, not as a societal ill, but as an idea, something we fight and worry about. And you say you hope that courts and citizens will recognize the anti-corruption principle as a foundational American principle. Okay, let's say we did that. Let's say we all agreed. Zephyr's right. Anti-corruption principle is foundational. How does society change? You've appointed the Supreme Court. Congress is listening to you. What are we dealing
with? Sounds great. Right. So I think one of the most fundamental things we need to do is change the way that we fund elections. In some ways, we've been just hobbling along with lots of imperfect ways of funding elections, jumping from one type, which is problematic, to another, and then banning things, but not actually building anything. So basically, the patronage system was how we funded elections for a long time. You know, I get an office and I give you a job. And you, as my employee, have to give me a percentage of your income to fund my elections. So we ban that and then don't replace it with anything. And what came into that void was privately financed elections. Initially, corporately financed elections, and that was banned. Directly corporately financed elections, that was then banned.
Can you give me both of those that you just explained are very interesting. How widespread was patronage funding? And then when you say direct corporate funding, give me some examples of what you mean.
So patronage funding was the way that our initial political parties were built. I mean, this really came out of the entrepreneurs, political entrepreneurs in the Jacksonian era, building parties which hadn't existed in the deep infrastructure sense before that time, the 1820s. And broadsheets, local meetings, all of that was funded through staffers of the winners paying the parties. And then in the 1880s, there begins an anti-patronage movement, which then both federally and in the states happens at slightly different times. And the 1880s on the federal level, you then see big corporations come in, and McKinley's campaign manager would go to the big banks and say, you owe X percentage. You got to pay that percentage as that's just part of the cost of doing business, because we're going to get into office. And then in 1907, the Tillman Act bans those direct corporate contributions. And actually, you don't see the same level as a percentage of GDP of campaign funding until the 1980s. So the Tillman Act actually had a huge impact with really shutting down the corporate funding. And then you see in the 1980s and 90s, corporate funding coming in other ways, and also private financing of elections really blowing up. There's this kind of sweet spot in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s where people's campaigns are financed privately, but there's an incredibly robust local media, and people are citizens are primarily getting their information from media sources, not from paid advertising. During this time, if you talk to Congress members from that time or read about them, they're fundraising. You know, they have a few events a year and then 1 week of making some phone calls. Even through the 80s, the fundraising is 2 weeks a year, which sounds wonderful.
Well, what is it now?
Now it's 30 to 70% of the time.
30 to 70?
30 to 70. So depending on your Congress member.
So, yeah. So right, it goes from a third to more than two. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I was hearing the level of spread there correctly. Yeah.
And I mean, these are in competitive races, it is the primary job of Congress members, and any Congress member who wants to move up within their own committee structure, it is the primary job of the Congress member.
I was listening to an interview with Senator Al Franken the other day, And in this interview, he sang his fundraising song. He used to do this so often to entertain himself. He has little songs for when he's calling, for if he leaves a message, for, I mean, you just spend a lot of time as a politician sitting in dark, windowless rooms, making these calls, sort of humiliating yourself.
It's totally right. I would say it's not only is it corrupting, which is a huge problem, but it changes who goes into public office. And then, like, it gets them in this habit of being kind of sycophants, you know, just calling rich people and telling them how they like their ideas. It's a kind of humiliating idea that we as this country have said, well, what we most want are people who are really, really, really good at begging rich people to give them $2,700, the federal maximum. So we've gone through these different regimes, and we're actually in a new regime now, post-Citizens United. Outside money is now quickly becoming more important than personally financed money. So I ran for Congress last year. There was more money spent by super PACs than by the candidates together. And I think that's true in most competitive congressional races. I think it's one of the big undertold stories of 2016, actually, because on the presidential level, super PACs played such a weird role this year. But on the presidential level, you have so much earned media. Earned media is media that you don't pay for, that it's just a very different dynamic. In local races, I mean, our race is about $18 million. More than half of that was super PACs.
So just to back out something you just said, because I think it's interesting and it's important. My sense of super PACs is they've been a little bit of a bust on the presidential level. 2012, they really failed. 2016, I mean, you look at Sanders, you look at Trump, then you look at what happened in the election itself. Super PACs did not perform that well. And I think some people have taken that to mean they're just a bust. But it seems to me, my read of the evidence is that spending money on persuasion is very difficult to do in informationally rich environments.
I think that's right.
Presidentials are,
yeah.
And pretty easy to do, or at least more effective in informationally poor environments. This is going to be a very political audience. And I think if I ask everybody here to on the spot, name their member of the House and state legislator, and if you have it, state senator, I think most people can't.
I play that game all the time with people. I'll just say, they'll be like, oh, but you got such good press coverage. And I'll just turn to them and be like, tell me within 5 seconds your Congress member. And these are people who read the New York Times, Washington Post, Vox, cover to cover every day.
I hope they're reading Vox cover to cover.
touche. Well, I had to throw it in there. But you take my point.
Yeah.
People don't, they're not following to the same degree. And the super PAC down ballot story was told this past cycle as everybody's fleeing Trump, which may or may not have been the reason. You know, everybody's fleeing the top of the ticket, mm-hmm. why there was a lot of money going down ballot. But it's not going away.
Right.
It was extremely effective. Our guess was that about 20% of local voters were getting their information from local news. So that means the only other information they have is, are you a D or are you an R, and campaign and then funded paid media.
All right. So what would you do?
Okay. So change the way you fund elections to publicly financed elections. There's different models on this. You know, I imagine if you had a constitutional convention right now, and it's not that the founders are all wise on all things, but we would be talking about publicly financed elections. But I think you should probably allow it in a federalist way, or allow different states to experiment with different kinds of publicly financed models. New York City has a model where if I get $5, it gets matched 6-1. So it's really transformed politics in the city. One of the big ways is there's a lot more challengers because people, non-incumbents can fundraise. Overturn Citizens United. I think those are the two most important things on the direct money and politics front. But related, I think that we should also deal with concentration of wealth and power. And the
just offhandedly, we should just deal with the concentration of wealth and power.
Deal with antitrust.
Just while we're doing that.
Because one of the things I actually came to believe is, as firmly as I care about changing the way that we fund elections, which I'm absolutely committed to, and changing, overturning Citizens United and Buckley versus Valeo, which I'm also absolutely committed to, is that once you allow entities to amass such incredible wealth and power, they will find other ways to use that wealth and power. so that we also have to talk about concentration of wealth and power in the corporate sphere, not just in how they spend the money.
So let me ask you let me raise my concern about the small donor matching equilibrium. Right. And in general, I'm supportive of these kinds of policies where, you know, up to $250, you get a 5-to-1 match or whatever it might be. But when I think of the problems our politics has, one problem certainly is corporate and just moneyed influence. No doubt about it. But another problem our politics has is an increasing pull towards, I don't just think it's sort of, I think it gets shorthanded as the extremes, but I don't think it quite is. I think it's a style of hyper-confrontational, hyper-partisan politics that can exist with different kinds of ideologies behind it. And, you know, I've seen some evidence, and intuitively it makes sense as well, that the candidates who really thrive in small donor environments are the sort of highly polarizing, highly ideological, highly confrontational. Michelle Bachmann was a monster of small donor. Like, she was just excellent at small donor fundraising. Alan West was great. Alan Grayson was great, right? Folks who, I think if you just stalked American politics with them, there are ups and downs to that.
Right.
But it would be a real war of all against all.
Right. No, I get that concern. So there's two things. One is, I just want to be clear about how bad it is now. It's not just that it's 30-70% of the time. It is actually impossible without the very rare candidate who takes fire on small dollar donations. It's impossible to be a candidate for federal office. I don't want to say impossible. My average contribution was $19 the last race. But it's very difficult without really, really saying things that are acceptable to the wealthiest 1 or 2%. And so that we have a real problem of both parties framing their language and their rhetoric and their ideas and their creativity to a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of America. And I gotta say, like, the anti-union sentiment among elites is incredibly strong, and that's true on left and right. That's not representative, but you're spending all your time with people who have the capacity to make or break your campaign. The problem is quite serious. It's really shaping our policy. The other is that the good small dollar funding models only allow for matches to exist within the jurisdiction that you are running in. And that constrains a lot of what you're talking about. Because what you're talking about is absolutely right, that on a national level, you'll see small dollar funding sort of swarm to candidates who have the sharpest or strongest or loudest, sometimes wonderful, sometimes terrifying voice. But on the local level, if you're talking about Congress, if you're talking about state houses, if you only provide the match locally, you have an incredibly different incentive system. So if you're running for state house and you're only getting a match from people within your district who give you a contribution, Your day is going to be different. Instead of spending your day talking to people in New York City or Washington, D.C. about what they think about teachers' unions, you're going to be spending your day in the district talking to anybody who can give you $100. And that's going to be a much broader ideological spectrum. And is that, in fact, kind of forces the kind of conversation that we want to have happen?
Let me ask you now about another kind of corruption. Mm-hmm. So we recently had an election, as you might have heard. And one of the effects of that election was we all became experts on the Emoluments Clause, which nobody had known about before.
Right.
You are an actual expert on the Emoluments Clause, and you're suing Donald Trump over it. So what is the Emoluments Clause, and how has Trump run afoul of it?
So I'm one of the lawyers on a suit representing Crew, a watchdog group in Washington, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and a few other plaintiffs suing Donald Trump for violating both the Foreign Emoluments Clause and the Domestic Emoluments Clause. These are two clauses in the Constitution that are anti-corruption clauses. The Foreign Emoluments Clause prohibits federal officers from taking presents, emoluments, offices, or titles of nobility of any kind whatever from a foreign government without congressional consent. And this is, I got interested in this clause when I started writing about corruption, because it was actually a very American clause. Like this clause saying that you couldn't take gifts and emoluments from foreign governments. Hold
on. Before we go further, I'm going to need you to define the word emolument.
Oh, yes. Okay, sure.
We keep saying it. I keep falling down the hole.
And you keep thinking, what kind of French moisturizer is that?
I am extremely good at nodding confidently while people say things I don't understand, but nobody can see me doing that here. Okay. So,
An emolument is a benefit. It's a benefit. And if you look at the word at the time, I think we now have this sense like, this strange word. But it was used in all kinds of documents at the time. And it covers all kinds of different benefits and profits and payments.
It does include profits because it feels like there might be a difference between the king of Norway, hands you a bejeweled pencil. And you have an international frozen food conglomerate and you make money from such and such. The one thing I want to establish as we go into this, because I think it's important for thinking about Trump, is that one way of thinking about this is that it's about gifts. It's about something that a foreign government just gives you to make you feel good. And another issue is Donald Trump has a hotel that has his name on it and his face on it and his name on it again in Scotland and in Istanbul and over and over and over again. But arguably, and that hotel can get money from the government, it can get tax breaks, all kinds of things can happen. But they're not, you could argue they're not giving him a gift. He's just a businessman who has international
interests. So the clause prohibits both gifts and emoluments. And it's really important that it includes both of those prohibitions because it's very clear that it's not just about the gifts. It would have been a very different clause if it just says that the federal officer cannot take presents of any kind, whatever, from foreign governments. Instead, it says presents, emoluments, titles of nobility, and offices. And if you look at the cases of the time or the understanding of emoluments at the founding, it was used to describe commercial transactions as well as payments in relationship to holding an office. So it's a very broad understanding. It starts broad and then it gets broader because it's one of the very few clauses in the Constitution that tells you how to read it. It has this phrase, of any kind, whatever. So like if you had any doubt about the scope of this word,
that's interesting.
We're going to read the broadest possible understanding of the clause. Now you might say, oh dear, what are we going to do about the King of Norway giving individual pens? That'll sort of mess up foreign relations if the King of Norway isn't allowed to give a pen. And the answer is, well, the King of Norway can give you a pen and you can keep it as long as you get the consent of Congress. And what Congress has done is develop in the presence area, not in the emoluments area, but in the presence area, is develop a basically body of law that provides for de minimis exceptions so that you don't have to turn to the king and say, I'm not taking this right now. But if it's under a couple hundred dollars, you can just say thank you. But once you rise to the level of over a couple hundred dollars, you just have to go through a procedure in order to be able to take the present.
But and there's something interesting about this that you say in the book, which is that this was actually unusual. This is Americans did this and it caused a lot of diplomatic confusion and friction for all. You have, I think this was actually in an op-ed you wrote, but you give this example of President Martin Van Buren having to write a letter to the Imam of Muscat telling him he cannot accept horses, pearls, a Persian rug, shawls, and a sword. Because it was against the law. And the imam is offended because other countries do have much more of a gift culture. They do offer titles onto each other. And that this is something that exists in American history for a purpose and is part of our distinct character.
Absolutely. It was called a fundamental law of our republic in that letter when Van Buren was writing back. There's a version of this in the Articles of Confederation. And there were a series of gifts given by the French king, and it actually caused some real problems because the diplomats didn't want to give offense. And it's not just that they didn't want to give offense. You're a totally new country that may or may not survive, right? And you're willing to put this principle above the fear of causing some problems with foreign relations. It just shows you how incredibly important this was to Americans to reject what they saw as the corrupt culture of Europe. And so there's some pride in the early understanding that we're going to stand up against that corrupt culture. We're going to reject corruption and we're going to reject foreign influence. But also they're pretty smart. They get it that foreign countries are going to try to influence policy by giving gifts or by having financial relationships in the commercial sphere with the officers, and that that can actually really have an influence.
So what are the emoluments that Donald Trump is receiving?
I'll just go through a few. One, you may be familiar with Trump Tower. It seems to be in the news fairly regularly.
I've heard of it.
So that there's two foreign governments who are tenants in Trump Tower. One is the commercial one is basically the government of China. The Commercial and Industrial Bank of China is one of the largest tenants in Trump Tower. That lease is up for renegotiation in 2019. So we have money from the Chinese government going into Donald Trump's pocket every month, and the possibility of the Chinese government using their leverage with that negotiation to leverage foreign policy. That's one area. A second area is the apprentice, the royalties for the apprentice and the celebrity apprentice and the new celebrity apprentice flow from, in at least two cases, foreign governments, because the royalties come from the governments itself. So the question is, if you look at foreign governments, it's not any foreign money. It's not private foreign money. What we're concerned about is foreign governmental money. Then there's the other example that you mentioned, which is the Trump Organization has developments and that there are financial benefits to those developments in Saudi Arabia and other countries that come from the government to the Trump Organization. One thing that more likely falls under the gifts part of the presents part of the emoluments clause is the trademarks that Trump received just immediately after agreeing to continue to support the One China policy. So the Trump Organization had been seeking trademarks in China for many, many years, finally came out saying, we do support the One China policy, and within a week gets the trademarks.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, gets the trademarks approved.
That doesn't seem fishy at all. Right. That seems totally normal.
Right. And so, but to your question about what's an emolument and what's a present, that looks to be more like a present because it's something that was a pure gift. It's not part of a commercial transaction. It's just, here you go for helping us out on One China.
And one of the things that is unnerving about this is, in addition to that, there are all these ties and linkages. And given that we don't have his tax returns, there's a lot we may not know. Trump really just does seem to be the kind of guy who, if you make sure that your biggest parties happen in his hotels and you sort of show that he's great, that it's a non-trivial part of foreign policy right there.
I think that's right. And I think that's the bet that foreign governments all over the world are making.
I mean, like, right. Saudi Arabia with that giant gold medal.
Right, I know.
It made me so embarrassed.
Yeah, it should.
That they had... that they had pinned, like, how easy America was now going to be to manipulate.
Yeah, and what's important is that there's two kinds of manipulation. One is that he can be having actual open conversations that we will not find out about that are kind of explicit deals, right? We don't know about that. And actually, this is one of the things the founders were worried about, is because Charles II in the 17th century had taken a pension from the French king, and in exchange really sold out a lot of British policy to the French. The terms of that sellout weren't made public for over 100 years. So there could be private, actual kind of transactional relationships that we will not find out about. But the other thing that's possible, which is what you're talking about, is Trump can be influenced without him knowing. And that's actually one of the key sort of psychological insights of the framers, is that we're influenced by people who give us stuff. We're influenced by people who make us rich. And it doesn't have to be transactional. It could just be like, hey, I kind of like these people now. This is just basic psychology. And so you need a procedural protection like consent of Congress to sort of put the stops on that subtle kind of influence.
So what are the difficulties of suing a sitting president of the United States? And where does this go from here?
All that we've seen so far is a few comments right before Trump became president. And if you wonder about the impact of this suit, just remember that in the press conference right before he became president, he had a few things to talk about, but mostly he brought out his lawyer and a big stack of envelopes to say, don't worry, I'm not violating the emoluments clause. So clearly that they should be, they have been impacted by this. after the government's reply, we'll give our own reply, and we'll get a sense of where they think the limits are. What we saw in January is that the Trump lawyers at the time, and this is before he's president, were saying he is going to give away all his profits from the Trump hotels that come from foreign diplomats. That's an emolument I didn't talk about earlier. He's not doing that. Even if he was doing it, you don't get to sort of sin against the Constitution and then pay a penance and say, hey, I'm going to put in the treasury all this money that I should never have taken. Like, you don't sort of unilaterally deciding that you don't owe the IRS money and then separately giving it to the treasury. You just don't, you don't get to do that. But that was the approach. And the other approach they had was that they said emoluments doesn't include commercial transactions. And we already talked about that. They're wrong as a matter of history and purpose, but we'll see if that's part of their brief going forward.
But will courts, I mean, this is just going to betray my own ignorance. I actually don't know just how difficult it is to sue the president.
I mean,
will courts give you standing, or does this end up in court, or is it a sort of long shot that you're hoping a judge will?
No, not at all. Offer? I mean, we're in court in the Southern District of New York. There'll be a legal fight about whether the plaintiffs that we have the right to sue. This is your standing question. But it's in terms of suing the president, I think the important thing to understand is we're not actually suing him for damages, which is problematic. We're just suing him for an injunction. Say, just stop violating the Constitution. What that means is he'd have to divest from his business interests, which is what other presidents have done. I mean, this is common practice, not just for presidents, but for federal officials, to divest of their interests and put them in a blind trust. And he should have done it before, and he can do it now. And we hope the court agrees with us and says he has to do that going forward.
This week on The Pitch, would you like fries with that?
People are what make franchises run. The person who knows the business inside and out. Yeah.
Yep.
Not someone who came off Wall Street because their check clears. Franchairs is the first investment marketplace where people can invest in franchises.
So you said $800 billion is what this market is a year. And hundreds of businesses are actually franchised businesses.
Thousands.
Thousands and thousands.
There are more brands franchised than there are stocks on the NASDAC.
Oh.
You're raising a $4 million price round.
And what are the terms on that?
The $19 million post-money valuation.
And do you not think that the valuation is a little frothy?
This week, things get frothy when Kenny Rose brings a new alternative investment class to retail investors. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch wherever you listen to podcasts.
So people, I think, hear the president's being sued for violating the Constitution, and people who are not fans of this president hope, oh, great, maybe the courts will just make him step down or something. That is not what this is.
No, it is not. No, this is, I mean, I think there's a few different things. It's really destabilizing to have your president making foreign policy decisions when his fingers are in the pie. I mean, it just casts a pall on every single foreign policy decision. But it also is a problem when your president is just openly violating the Constitution. I mean, that's a rule of law problem itself, to say that I don't really care about the words here. I think there's a value in him stopping that has to do with just basic rule of law principles as well.
There are a lot of problems right now.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, this is off our topic a little bit, but we're talking in the pretty immediate aftermath of the Comey testimony.
Yeah.
And the thing that I've been obsessing over since has been what we know about Trump. Put aside any questions of technical obstruction of justice. What we know about Trump, he's talked forever about how loyalty is a quality he most values in subordinates. He actually has in his first book a passage where he says that he prefers people who put loyalty over integrity, which is such an astonishing passage.
Not surprising, but really astonishing.
He's talking about Roy Cohn, who was McCarthy's sort of attack dog, Joseph McCarthy's attack dog, who's a later Donald Trump mentor. And he says the great thing about Roy Cohn, there are all these guys who have all this integrity, but not enough loyalty. And Cohn was the opposite, which most people would not say is a good thing. But so what we know happens with Comey is that Donald Trump pulls him aside and says, you know, I want your loyalty. And Comey gets very uncomfortable, and Republicans are sort of bashing him now for not standing up enough to Trump. But what we know is the FBI director is a pretty, you know, brave guy, hears about a lot of threats on the daily, has stood up to governmental pressure before, and he doesn't fold to Trump, but he is made very uncomfortable and does not sort of push back. How many other times in our government is this happening? Who is actually giving Donald Trump his loyalty?
Who else is being asked for loyalty? Right.
It makes it so you really can't trust anything in the government. I mean, it is impossible.
Because it's not just a mistrust of Trump. It's a mistrust then.
Right. Yeah. So Trump is named Christopher Wray to be FBI director. He interviewed a large number of candidates. He somehow chose Wray. Wray is not unqualified, but he's not by any means the most qualified. What made him choose Wray? Was it that they had a conversation about loyalty somehow or another, and Trump got the impression that Wray would be loyal? And maybe that's super unfair to Christopher Wray, but everything is under that cloud now.
Yeah, it's an enormous cost. And this is where you're thinking like a framer. When you said you're sort of not as focused on the question of whether there's an obstruction of justice, which is a fascinating question, but it's that we can get lost in those weeds and instead say, do we have a structural system right now that is deeply problematic? And is there anything we can do about that?
This is something I've been talking about this with members of my staff for the last couple of days, but I think people have gotten a sort of confused idea of what impeachment is and for.
They have, yes.
That impeachment is not a legal remedy.
No.
Right? So this question of did Trump, like, are you going...
I have felt that too. I felt like there's this weird kind of hunt for if he did, then he can be impeached. And if he didn't...
But it's a political remedy.
Yes.
And it's, you know, enough members of Congress deciding that the president has done something really beyond the pale. And obviously, if they begin deciding that on a whim, that would be very bad. But this is a president who clearly fired the FBI director to squelch an investigation into Russia, and in his behavior has shown that pretty much everything in government can no longer be trusted so long as he is appointing the key figures in it. And, you know, you can argue whether that is what you want to activate a political remedy, but what you would be dealing with is a political remedy for a political problem. The foundations of our government have been corroded.
I think that's right. There's basically these three theories of impeachment. One is that it's absolutely political and they could impeach him because they didn't like his pulling out of the Paris climate deal. You know, it could be something like that. The other extreme is that it has to be tied to a particular crime. I tend to take the third approach, which is that it is appropriate when there's a significant violation of public trust, and that's what high crimes and misdemeanors relates to. High, the word high in high crime or high misdemeanor being related historically in England to violations of the public trust. And so then you're not on this technical hunt, because the other side of the coin of the technical hunt is that every time you find a crime, then you should impeach, which also seems wrong. It's not, is there a crime or isn't there a crime? It's, is this person violating some fundamental tenets of governing?
But also the flip of it, I mean, crimes are a little bit just weird to think about with the presidency, because I understand, the president can just say, Steve Bannon, I would like you to kill three of my enemies and then pardon him. And it isn't clear that anything has been done wrong there. Right, he has a unlimited pardon power. The presidency is very powerful.
So let me walk. I'll have to take a second to think about that hypothetical.
This
but yeah,
what
but
one
I take your broad. Yes,
said to,
right.
As one person explained it to me, the idea that I have seen people interpret impeachment as purely a legal mechanism.
I think that's right.
That if the president has not committed a crime, there's no activation there, then the only remedy is electoral.
That clearly can't be true. That clearly can't be true. I think less so for the pardoning example, because I guess what I'm resisting is what I think is a very dangerous Trumpian view, which is I am above the law in all of these ways. He can be subject to the law and still not subject to impeachment. I mean, we're suing him. He's still subject to the law, even though there's limits on our capacity to sue. He's still subject to it. But I think I really agree with your deep point, which is that it's this technical hunt is not helping us. And I think there's almost a sense that if we can find obstruction of justice, then he'll go, which is also clearly not true.
Yeah, no, it has it goes both ways, right? You can find an actual crime and it doesn't practically do anything. But this, to me, it actually speaks to what I think of as a big theme of this conversation, which is that there are many serious problems afflicting American politics right now, but both prior to Trump and now in the Trump era, one of the most severe, in my view, is the absolute pervasive appearance of corruption in all things. Even among people who are just normal politicians, right? I mean, recently President Obama left the presidency and then gave a $400,000 speech to Cantor Fitzgerald. And Cantor Fitzgerald is not a toxic bond firm that I know of. I mean, they're not somebody who people hate in the way they've come to hate, you know, a Goldman Sachs. But it's the kind of thing where, you know, I think Obama presumably looked at that and said, yeah, these guys are not a big deal. You know, like, I'm going to go give them a speech. But it's just, it's kind of everywhere now, and it's corrosive, and it's upsetting to people.
He shouldn't have done it, not because it's against the law.
Right.
And I don't need to spend a lot of time on the dangers of his particular action, but it does reflect and it sort of taps into people's readiness for cynicism.
Right.
So it's saying, oh, everybody's, you know, not that he's doing anything illegal, not that he is corrupt per se, but that one might hope that he would use the incredible public platform he has, and he makes enough money also.
The thing it caused me to reflect on, because then shortly thereafter, Hillary Clinton was interviewed at Recode and, you know, asked about the speeches she gave, particularly to Goldman Sachs. And she said, everybody gives these speeches, right? Like, all my predecessors got to do it. And I think that's a little bit where presumably Obama's coming from, too. A lot of people did it, and Cantor Fitzgerald wouldn't have looked necessarily toxic to him, though they are a bond firm. And this kind of everybody does it.
Yeah.
Trump begins moving the bar in very, very different ways. But I think people like sort of step back from this, and the whole thing, the whole edifice seems rotten to them, even in places where it isn't, which I think is quite dangerous.
Because there's a lot of incredible public servants.
Yeah.
And one example of this, and I think it relates to your legalism point, though, is Hillary Clinton's foundation.
Yeah.
That the defense of Hillary Clinton's foundation by the Clinton team and others was that it's not illegal, which is true. Not illegal. You know, it raises shadows of the Emoluments Clause, but doesn't look like an Emoluments Clause violation. But once you get in a world where you're saying we can do anything that isn't illegal and it's okay, that's a very dangerous world. And it also suggests two different kinds of language. One of the things Mark Twain writes about as a novelist, not as an essayist, in his book, The Gilded Age, is that the language of corruption in that time really splits, where there's an elite that thinks a whole bunch of things aren't corrupt. They're just the way things are. And everybody else is saying, wait a second, the whole system is corrupt. And I think we have that kind of split of language where elites just get used to things and say, that's not corrupt. That's just the way we do things.
It seems to me that if I were a politician who, or an advisor to a politician, I would see, or fuck it, I'm not a politician, but I'm somebody who comments on politics. I have come to see the appearance of corruption, the belief in corruption on the part of the citizenry as a really big problem. And that it's not, you cannot just solve that problem by solving what is illegal.
No, you can't.
You have to solve that problem by people just holding themselves to a much higher standard, even a standard that might feel unfair. You know, a good example of this that I think about sometimes is the Trump administration has given tons of lobbyist waivers, but the Obama administration gave some too. And the Obama administration, you know, and I was reporting on them at that time and spoke to them about this. And, you know, they would say, listen, we have these jobs that are of incredible importance. We're dealing with a financial crisis. We have to re-regulate the financial industries. There are people who are the best people for these positions, and it is worth more that we get those people in, even if it means giving this waiver. And in an individual case by case, that completely makes sense. And I hire for much less consequential positions, and hiring's damn hard. So, I mean, that's difficult too. But the cumulative effect of a lot of individual decisions that don't seem that wrong is really poisonous. I had Cory Booker, Senator Cory Booker, on the show recently, and he had gotten in crosswise with the left because, you know, he believed that a drug reimportation bill did not have enough safety mechanisms. And ultimately, him and Bernie Sanders worked it out and then came together on a bill, and now they have a joint proposal. But, you know, he was very taken aback by the degree which people, his critics, just wouldn't believe that he actually just believed that.
Oh, that they're looking for a financial reason.
It's not even just that they're looking for one. They just, I see it all the time in the way people sort of explain political behavior. They just almost always assume there is one. Now, I don't know in any given case if that's right or wrong, but it's a terrible thing that people believe it so often. And it probably is right a lot of the time.
But it's why I actually think structural change is so important, because what we then, there are certain things that people can do right away in terms of revolving door, speech money, taking speech money, making a personal commitment to never never make a policy decision based on their donor. But these are all individual things. If we're not actually dealing with the basic structure of things, if we're not actually changing the way we fund elections, if we're not actually, you know, something we haven't talked about today, but like busting up big corporations, if we're not actually dealing with the sort of fundamental roots of this cynicism, I think there'll be some flash in the pan moments, but the cynicism will only grow.
So I want to talk about busting up big corporations. But before I want to talk about one other piece of this. It is part of it that I struggle with when I think about what would count as a solution, right? Not a solution, but among solutions, which is, I think, the powerful argument one would make against this conversation that we're having right here is that big corporations are a genuine part of the economy, of genuine and real interests, and a reason to those interests need to be heard and reflected. But more than that, that it becomes very inconsistent what people who do have to participate in and deal with the economy are allowed to do. So I think of this sometimes. You see four members of government go out and they just work for corporations they didn't regulate, and people get very upset. And it's like, well, okay, like, what are you allowed to do and still be seen as someone who can act in public service? At what point do you begin to run into a problem where the boundaries you're drawing are really a form of vilification? And instead of having dealt with a way of stopping the appearance of corruption, what you've really done is load the deck. So yeah, it's fine if you worked for this kind of corporation, but not this one. Or it's fine if you made this much money, but not that much money. And while, you know, I don't exactly sort of cry for the people I imagine being disadvantaged by this, I do think that there's, you know, people on the right certainly make a good argument that there are, you know, forms of money and forms of corporate tie that people on the left get upset about and that they don't. And that sometimes this can be a way of sneaking in sort of ideas of who is a legitimate actor in public policy, as opposed to actually dealing with corruption.
Okay, so a few things. One is I don't think I did an effective enough job explaining how transformational public financing of elections would be in so many different ways, and how I think that, along with revolving door and other reforms, but really publicly financed elections and overturning Citizens United are the key. Because what we really want to know is if somebody wakes up in the middle of the night, are they thinking about the network of rich people tied to Microsoft in Seattle, even though they live in Kansas, or are they thinking about their constituents? Are they really focused on the water quality and the schools of their constituents? That's what we really want to know. We want to have structures that allow for that. And right now we have a deeply broken structure that encourages people in public office to spend their time thinking about people who are not their constituents and not representative. And that is profoundly corrupting, and we can change that. I also think it relates to the revolving door issue, is that once you get in a system where you're just spending all your time talking to the wealthiest people in world history, it's very natural for you to take a job in that world. Mm-hmm. And it's actually hard to imagine the other kinds of jobs and outlets and things you can do. That's your sort of social community. And so that once you change the way you fund elections, you also change the future career paths, not just by revolving door legislation, but by the kind of culture and people that you hang out with. So that, I just want to be clear about how transformational that is. And then also be clear that every revolving door rule is going to leave people out in the cold for some great opportunities. And that's terrible. But it's just not that terrible. Like, it's not nearly as terrible as saving our republic, as the sort of threat to our republic. I mean, it's terrible I can't go 75 miles on the highway when I want to, you know, get to somebody's wedding on time, and I accept the speed limit. We accept speed limits not as fundamental attacks on our freedom, but just as, like, you know, you sometimes got to have rules that make it less likely that people are going to die. And that's how I feel about revolving door rules and campaign limit rules, is that we just have to have rules that make it a little more likely that people are actually going to have a voice.
Let's talk about breaking up corporations, because one of the things I'm tracking a little bit, I actually spoke to your lieutenant governor candidate on this podcast.
Oh, Tim. Wu, oh, great.
About this maybe 6 or 8 months ago. But I'm very interested in the rise of anti-monopolist thinking again on the left, and the degree to which people are starting to really take this as a central political concern, so an essential economic concern. So I wanted to start the conversation this way. When you worry about monopoly and rising monopoly power, concentration of power, What are you worried about? What problem are you trying to solve?
What I'm concerned about is our public government getting taken over by forms of private government. And this is an age-old concern, which, by the way, was not historically left or right, has certainly been part of Republican right-wing platforms as well in American history. Thomas Jefferson wanted an anti-monopoly clause in the Constitution. The letter that he wrote to Madison about wanting a First Amendment also included a desire for an anti-monopoly clause because what he was worried about is publicly enabled private power becoming a form of government. That's the deepest fear. There's also a lot of secondary fears like inequality, lowering wages. Our employment rates are doing okay, but the wage depression is incredible. There's recent research that suggests that wage depression is tied to concentration. There is decrease in quality and innovation. I mean, our small business environment in the United States, it's a pretty bad environment for small businesses. Our startups are down. We're behind Europe in a lot of areas. There's a recent report by really mainstream Council of Economic Advisors saying we've got a problem with entrepreneurship in this country. And then if you're concerned just about prices, economist John Cuoca came out with a report this last year showing that mergers, incredible amount of mergers, lead to higher prices as well. So there's a whole range of issues. But I actually, to me, the core is that we're getting taken over by private companies. And they're not acting like the entrepreneurial open.
When you say we're getting taken over, because I actually want to separate out the political and the economic here.
Maybe that's where we're going to disagree.
No, but yeah, so maybe we can't. But I guess if the question is we're getting taken over by private corporations, then one might say, well, what we should really just do is publicly finance elections rather than break up Google. Whereas if the question is markets are becoming closed to new entrants, then you might not be able to do it by anything but like direct antitrust
prevention. I don't think you can separate those two. And I'll just give you one example that you may or may not have heard about. If you saw the John Oliver special a year and a half ago on chickenization, you might have. But in the chicken industry, they're independent, quote unquote, independent contractors, small businesses that sell their chickens to Tyson. In reality, these small businesses are completely controlled by Tyson, right? They have to use the feed that Tyson tells them to use. They have to use the eggs that Tyson tells them to use. They have to – actually, that Tyson gives them. They have to use the exact specs.
Well, you've generally picked the – I'm vegan, and you've picked the industry that I burn like large and small to the ground.
Great. So just to make you like it even less The chicken industry has this problematic relationship with these independent contractors, and the Obama administration decides to have hearings on what's going on with contractors. They have hearings all around the countries. They're show trials because the chicken farmers, and I've talked to several reporters and one chicken farmer several reporters who reported on this and a chicken farmer who talked about it himself, they said, we're not going to show up to a hearing telling the government what's wrong with Tyson, because then we're going to lose all our money because then they're not going to give us good chicks and they're not going to distribute our goods. So you have this new form of political fear. This is called chickenization, actually, and it's spreading to the beef industry. So the beef is actually modeling its own industry after that. But I'd argue that in industry after industry, we have a chickenization model. Like when I've gone on MSNBC, I think twice people have said, do you really have to bring up the Comcast Time Warner merger? You know, that these are people sort of quietly saying, I hope you don't talk about my boss on air. Because there's a growing silencing by a handful of big corporations about things that we can and can't say.
I will say, as a company that has investment from Comcast, we say a lot of bad things about Comcast, actually. But I actually want to separate two questions there, because what I think of is the Comcast Time Warner or who is it, AT&T? Who is AT&T going to merge with? Somebody.
The last year, there were 48,000 mergers. 2015 and 2016 were the highest two number of mergers in American history.
One of the things I find really interesting and have been, you know, pretty persuaded on myself is that people are used to thinking about monopolies, and they're not that used to thinking about monopsonies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where it's sort of the supplier who is exerting control downstream. And that sounds like what the Tyson situation is. It was certainly, I mean, now Amazon is a massive competitor, but Walmart really had, and maybe to some degree still does have this power to really set policy to set wages.
You know, all the analogies fall apart a little bit, but so I don't want to say it is feudal, but it's feudal-like when mm-hmm. Amazon is telling Coca-Cola, if you want to be on our shelf, you got to use the sweetener that we want you to use. That's not Coca-Cola acting as an independent business. You know, that's Coca-Cola under so this is Walmart, under Walmart.
I do often worry about Coca-Cola being underpowered.
but it's a question of sort of governance and power. And you started with saying we should separate the political and economic. And I actually think that's where we mess up, is understanding that the economic threats are tied to the political threats.
Here's why I said that, because I think this gets to something interesting. One of the things, as I read it, and I am not an expert in this space, but that happened was there became the belief that if you could just show that a particular monopoly or a particular concentration, particular firm or particular merger would not hurt consumers, that it was fine.
Great.
That if you could say, hey, the economic effects of this are okay, then there's nothing to be done about it, because really, who is the loser? And then there's this other, what I think of as a somewhat cross-cutting argument that, you know what, it might be that Walmart is pushing prices down. It might be that there are advantages to the consumer. But in a macro sense, in an aggregate sense, all of these monopolies create a politically imbalanced sphere that over the long run has negative effects. It feels like when you merge those, if what you're trying to address is sort of specific economic problems, then oftentimes you might just be better off addressing the specific economic problem, right? If you're worried that wages are too low at the bottom, maybe you just want to do a minimum wage increase and an EITC increase. But if you're worried that the political system will consistently be biased in a harmful way because of the power of these corporations, then maybe that doesn't get you that far.
Yeah. A few different things. One is I want to sort of emphasize what you described, because it's really important. It's a real revolution. You can call it the consumer welfare revolution. And antitrust laws, Sherman Act and the Clayton Act, are written really broadly, actually. So they're almost like constitutional clauses, that they just use the word, you know, monopolization, and then it's up for judges to fill in the content of what that word means. And different judges at different times have filled that in differently. Although for most of history, it was really clear that it covered a lot of what's happening in America today. In the 70s, you really see this revolution where the courts say the only thing that matters is consumer welfare. Not just consumer price, but pretty close to the only thing that matters is consumer price. And what that leads to is also a belief that you can have competition without competitors, that you can have a world where there is a totally dominant player, but because there are potential competitors and that dominant player seems to be doing okay on price for now, we're not going to get involved. The old regime says free markets are rare, they're amazing, they're wonderful, but they take certain structures. Certain things have to exist for a free market to exist. And one of the things that we have to do to ensure competition is to ensure that there are, in fact, no truly dominant players. That, to me, addresses both the economic and the political, and they are tied. Because one of the things that you see, for instance, in the chicken area, because I found a sweet spot for you apparently, when you see these incredible mergers, at first you see prices go down. So if you're in the modern consumer welfare antitrust regime, this is great. Prices are going. But then after a decade, they start coming up. Because once you have that dominance, then you can use that dominance to steal all kinds of value. But it's really hard for a court to say, we're going to look 10 years out and see the kind of ways in which you're going to abuse that dominance. So I think we should go back to a much more workable regime and then deal with some of the current problems that we have. Because we're out of control in terms of consolidation right now. Like it's... the area that you know really well, I'd be interested to hear what you see in the healthcare area. But you certainly see, as far as I can tell, price impacts from hospital consolidation. Mm-hmm. And those are very real impacts, as well as political impacts. And then you also see in the pharma area,
It's funny in the healthcare area, because a solution that I am interested in and that other people are interested in, because it's how other countries work to some degree, is all payer rate setting, which would effectively, it isn't itself a consolidation, but it allows private and public buyers much more power to bargain down prices with providers. Now, on the one hand, what you've got there is something that is more like consolidation. But I also think the dynamics of healthcare are quite unusual. But when you think about that regime, is the kind of outcome we're thinking about here rules-based? Are we saying that an industry, as we define it, should not get above X percentage consolidation with its major players or its major two or three players? Are we talking about just having people run the antitrust department who have a somewhat different theory and are more aggressive? What does that look like? Because I think that when people talk about this in the abstract, it all sounds pretty good. I mean, who wants giant, super powerful corporations controlling everything? But then it's like, well, do you want to break up Google? Like, they are clearly a monopolist in search, right? It's only when you start redefining their industry that you can get away from that.
Right.
Like, where does it lead?
Yeah, so I think there's what's exciting about this year, and you're right to sort of note that there's a lot of new energy around this. Luigi Zingales, who's a Republican at University of Chicago, has been talking about this for a couple of years now, that this is a real threat to market freedom, that the concentration. And actually, I was at a conference last month at the Chicago School, the school that brought on consumer welfare, where people were saying, yeah, we might have got it wrong. You know, there's something clearly off in the American economy, and it relates to politics. Specific things we can do. One is that the low-hanging fruit is not allow this kind of merger wave that we're seeing right now, and be a lot more skeptical and scrutinize mergers a lot more closely. That, I think, again, I just want to repeat that the last 2 years were the highest number of mergers on record ever. So we're in the middle of one of these waves, and we've got to do something about that. The second is in the area of the platform monopolists, Facebook, Google, Amazon, there are special problems there. And I think calling on some of the old traditions of competition policy or monopoly policy or monopsony policy, if you want to call it that, you know, I put them all in the same category, is important. So some of those old traditions would say, it's really important for us to have Google. We believe in Google, or we believe that it's important. This is a really important service. But what we don't like is for Google to be able to own a competitor to Yelp. So I just use Yelp as an example. You may sometimes use Yelp to find a restaurant.
I've Yelped.
You've Yelped. Okay. But Google controls its own search results, and it's competing against Yelp now for restaurant ratings and for, you know, your hair salon. Pick your topic. The fact that it's competing against something like Yelp is kind of problematic, because then it makes it really hard for not just Yelp to compete, but any other company that might want to come along and also be a competitor in that space. So cross-ownership, we should be extremely skeptical of cross-ownership. And what you've seen in the last 30 years is a judiciary that has allowed all kinds of what we call vertical integration or cross-ownership that would not have allowed it before. That may require new legislation. And some of that may have to happen at the state level, just given the current Congress. But certainly there's a possibility of people introducing legislation. So I think the platform monopolists pose a special challenge. The other thing you can do with platform monopolists is require a certain degree of neutrality. And certainly Europe is very involved in these questions. They're really seen as ahead of the United States in dealing with the democratic and economic threats posed by the platform monopolists. And I think it's something that we should be looking into here. And then there's the question of those companies that have already used the current permissiveness with mergers over the last 30 years that are not Google or Amazon or Facebook. Should we be pushing for divestiture in the sort of in the real breakup area? And I think the answer has to be yes, so that we have to undo some of the bad things that have already been done. And then the final area is looking at the role the financial sector plays in consolidation. I mean, Goldman Sachs has made so much money off of M&A. So it's not companies on their own choosing to merge. It's also the financial sector really encouraging that kind of action.
So,
and that's just the tip of the iceberg.
I worry we'll have to go down the rest of the iceberg in another episode. Before we close out, the question we always ask to end the podcast is, what are three books that you've read that have influenced you that you would recommend to folks listening?
Oh, fantastic. Well, everybody has to read Middlemarch. It's one of the greatest books ever written, and also some good stuff on corruption. I'd suggest The Gilded Age by Mark Twain. And then my all-time favorite is probably All the King's Men.
Oh, All the King's Men is so good. Zephyr Teachout, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you to Zephyr Teachout for being here. I hope you all enjoyed that as much as I did. Thank you to my producer, Bird Pinkerton. The Ezra Klein Show will be back next week.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.